Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host, Tom Wheeler, Executive Director of the Environmental Protection Information Center, or EPIC. And I'm joined by my friends and colleagues, Larry Glass of the North Coast Environmental Center. Hey, Larry.
Hey, Tom.
Scott Greeson of the Friends of the Yellow River.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Well, hi, Scott. And we are also joined in the studio by Monty Merrick, the co-director of Bird Ally X and one of the great folks who help run our Humboldt Wildlife Care Center. Hey, Monty.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for having me on.
We're going to be talking about some of the sort of terrible ways that humans affect wildlife here and what we can do about it. In particular, I want to drive down and provide listeners with resources on how they can minimize their harmful exposure to wildlife and what they can do if they come across wildlife that has been injured or harmed in some way. So to start off, just tell us a little bit about the Wildlife Care Center and the patients that you treat.
Well, Humboldt Wildlife Care Center, which has been a part of the Humboldt Bay Area community since 1979, treats, it's easy to explain it. Some person walks down the street or finds in their yard an injured or an orphaned wild animal, and we are the resource that they can go to. And we will take that animal, admit them for care. If all goes fantastic, that animal recovers from whatever the ailment was that caused them to be able to be picked up by a human being in the first place. And then they are released back to their lives, which had been so rudely interrupted. Obviously, everything doesn't always go well. And there's a lot of patients that we admit. So we may as well start with the bad news first, which is most animals that get brought to us were hit by a car on the highway. And mostly they have injuries that they're not going to recover from. But sadly, the fate has left them still alive. We take care of that for them in the most humane way that we can. And that's a huge part of our work, actually, is just ending suffering. After that part happens, which when it's done best, it happens within, you know, an hour of the patient being admitted. We do an exam and determine that, and it's over. Then all of the rest of the animals are those who, like, we think we can get this guy back. We can return this animal to the wild. And then we try. And sometimes we fail. But we have, once you eliminate those first, say, 50% that are just so messed up, after that, we have a pretty good track record. That's what we do. And we have specially built housing, aviaries for certain types of birds, like raptors versus aviaries for other types of birds, like songbirds. Right now, this is our slow season, although it's been actually pretty busy. We're at about 80 animals so far for the year since January 1st, 80 patients. The patients range from as common as fox sparrow, who winter here and you just go outside and you can just see them almost any time you want to. You're just like, I feel like seeing a fox sparrow, so I'm going to walk outside and look for one and you'll find one. 2 days ago, we admitted a brown booby that was found off of Whidley Island.
Okay, so I got the big question that really ought to frame up this entire podcast. Monty, I need you to explain something that's been bothering me for years.
Okay.
What is the relationship between Bird Ally X, Racer X, and Malcolm X?
Okay. Well, first of all, Racer X is, of course, unbeknownst to Speed, his older brother,
right,
who raced against Pop Racer's wishes and was banished from the family. But he continued racing.
Yeah.
And under Racer X, his real name is Rex Racer.
All true, as far as I can tell.
And Speed doesn't know it.
Right.
Speed is often competing with him, except for the one episode where Speed lost the use of his legs and Racer X lost the use of his eyes, and so they drove the race car together.
Right. That was a cool one.
It was pretty good.
Yeah.
Not as good as the Mammoth car, but
right,
way up there. Has no relationship to Bird Ally X.
What?
Except for the part where I was a Speed Racer fan unto my dying breath, but mostly as a child in the 1960s.
Well, that makes two of us.
Malcolm X actually has some relationship to the name Bird Ally X because of the inherent mystery in his last name, right? The X's he rejected little, but had nothing to replace it with. When Bird Ally X was being formed, the Bird Ally part was already there, largely invented by my spouse, who was working on an art dance film project and wrote a part for me after I came back from working in the desert rescuing birds. The part was called the Bird Ally.
Because Bird Whisperer was just a little too much.
Yeah. And we were forming the organization and I was really not that interested in like West Coast Wildlife Alliance for Bird Conservation or a name like that or anything like that. So we were just basically looking at what is the most important feature of what we're doing. And that is the kind of anonymity, the wild animal first. But, you know, there's something kind of axe grindy about that because of where I was working at the time and where I had worked in the past and the human politics that constantly came in the way of patient care. And it was a sort of an attempt to put it right out first forward in our name. Obviously, we formed it in 2009. If I had known how those 10 years were going to go in the broader political dialogue, I wouldn't have used the word ally, because I meant the word ally like World War II sense of ally, like equal partners in the same fight, not like cheerleaders standing on the sidelines hoping it goes works out great for you. So the intent was to really eliminate the personalities and put ourselves on the front lines with the animals that we treat, who are constantly being up against the challenges of living with humans.
How many calls a day does the care center typically get?
Well, a day, it depends on the time of year. Yeah. Summer's obviously much busier than winter, just because A, babies, and B, people are outside in the nice weather. So we answer the phone thousands of times a year. Last, I think, 2019, we have 5,000 phone calls.
Wow. 365
days goes into 5,000 a certain number of times, which would be about...
More than a dozen calls a day. Yeah.
We'll say a dozen.
Yeah. And you also provide resources for folks over the phones.
We do. Probably we do the lion's share of our work over the phone, because over the phone, we're able to prevent conflicts from blooming into an injury or an orphaning. Raccoons are a perfect example of this, because we spend a lot of time each day on the phone talking people through the problem of having raccoon babies in their house. It's actually a very easy problem to solve. It does require a little bit of ingenuity sometimes, but there's certain steps that we have, like, you know, just because years and years and years of giving advice, and we give good advice, because the last thing in the world we want to do is tell somebody to do something that doesn't work, because then they will A, do something probably lethal, and B, they're never going to believe the non-lethal thing ever again. Remember Hippie dish soaps in the 1990s, how poor they were? But nowadays you can get a good Hippie dish soap that actually works. There's lots of soaps that work, but it took a while. We don't want to be in that situation where we're telling people, oh, use this eco-friendly soap that will never clean anything and actually leaves your hands feeling slimy. So, you know, it's really important to us. So we're using battle-tested methods to prevent baby raccoons from getting into people's house, you know, being born there, or convincing raccoon moms to move their babies once they've had them there. And that's actually a fairly easy thing to do.
So how do you convince some raccoon mom to get the heck out of your attic?
Let's say that, so a typical call goes something like, yeah, we have raccoons in our house. I can hear them in the walls and they're driving me crazy. I just want to know, can I borrow a trap? And so we're starting early at square one. So first of all, we have to like let them know that actually there are regulations for trapping wild animals. Now, whether or not those regulations are enforced is another story entirely. But the regulations are that you do need a permit from CDFW to trap a wild animal. You do have to notify everybody within 150 yards of where you're putting that trap, that you're putting one out. And that makes really good sense, actually, because cats, dogs, non-target animals, have a heart trap, does not know who's in it. That's solid. And also, trapping and relocating a mom does, in fact, leave orphans behind. Back in 2014, we had that trapped raccoon who was reported as being a male, and we went back and found four dead babies, which turned into that big petition that we had about trapping wild animals here in Humboldt County. Obviously, we didn't trap that animal. When you do trap an animal who's in your house, there's a strong likelihood that it's a mom with babies, because your house doesn't hold that many attractions for a wild animal, except for temporary safety when eyes closed babies who are still nursing actually need protection. And if you think about it, favorite raccoon spot is the void behind a bathtub. And if you put four babies in there and one raccoon mom, what predator is going to go under a house and up through the hole she found and then go into that space with her? It's extremely safe. Depending on the hygiene of the homeowners, periodically it gets nice and toasty warm there. It's an incredibly intelligent place. Now, if suddenly that were to go south, and here's how we can make it go south, we can introduce lights to that void. Talk radio is excellent. Just basically just turning it into a place that she doesn't feel safe anymore. Convincing a raccoon mom that her den site has gone south will prompt her to move her babies to her plan B. And she generally will have one, because raccoon, super smart. Obviously, the gold standard for when people have this problem, because something could still happen, right? She's got four babies that she now has to move to a new den site. And that means taking them from safety across not safety to safety. And that across not safety period, which could be Broadway, it could be all kinds of places. So there's still the risk that you are really disrupting that family. People that are able to tolerate for 2 months at the most those raccoons under their house, and then after they've moved out, we can go check out, make sure that they're gone. Then they can close the problem that allowed it in the first place.
We can prevent having a problem in the first place by adequately screening your
vents, foundation, whatever it is. Then this is the right, exact right time of year, especially regarding skunks, because right now is when skunk mamas are on the move looking for a place to set up a den site. You'll notice if you pay attention on the highways when you drive around, January, February, there's always more dead skunks on the road. They're totally on the move.
I see them every time I drive the 101.
And Simola Boulevard, just here to Manila, is good every day for a couple of dead skunks. Yeah. And, you know, it's tragic, and that's an entirely different issue. But the point is that that's evidence that this is the time of year to go around your house, do a perimeter check, and just make sure. Because not only are you protecting your own property, but you're actually really making life better for wildlife. Using human structures for den sites is both intelligent, but it is an extremely risky proposition because I don't know if you've noticed this or not, but some people aren't very nice.
So we've dealt with what to do with a raccoon under your house. What are some of your other most common calls?
Well, beach seabirds around here is a pretty common call, and that's usually anthropogenic. Well, actually, we can't even really tell anymore because ocean conditions are just so poor. We don't know. It's really hard to tell when a seabird wreck is natural and when it's not natural at this point. So we don't even really get too involved with parsing that out. We just assume that the ocean has turned into a hellish environment and consider them to be human-caused. But beach seabirds are fairly common. We just had, remember the bomb cyclone at the end of November?
Oh, yeah.
That day we admitted 28 Leach's storm petrels.
Wow.
And we were getting them from as far inland as Hoopa.
Wow.
And in Hoopa, they were letting us know that 8 came in from Hoopa Tribal Forestry. They let us know that they found 30 dead ones.
Holy crap.
So, wow. You know, that storm really wreaked havoc, and we don't know the extent. You probably saw that study that just came out from the 2015-16 over the winter common myrrh die-off that we experienced. It was really from Southern California to Alaska. I can't remember the number of carcasses they had, but I think it was in the neighborhood of 60,000. But they extrapolated that 1 million myrrhs died that winter.
Right.
And that's myrrhs. Any seabird especially, I mean, you know, that has a similar life history, that feeds the same way, that uses the same waters, probably was having the same problems. Here in Humboldt, because we have what is widely regarded as maybe a last stand chance for wild animals to still be able to live something like a normal life as eco-collapse proceeds around us. When we have washed up seabirds here, it's kind of depressing, but it's nothing at all like, say, in Southern California, the numbers that we see when those sorts of things happen. But in May, we did have another myrrh crash, and it happened right at the beginning of baby season, right when they'd be laying eggs. But it was mostly centered around Fort Bragg, but we got like 200 dead myrrhs or Fort Bragg at the end of May. So that's just ongoing. You know, we have been tracking, you know, because we raise babies. Mm-hmm. And myrrhs nest right here off of Trinidad, among other places, Castle Rock up in Crescent City. They're all over the coast. Really, as far south as Devil's Slide is probably about as far south as they breed in California. But up through 2015, we treated about 20 to 30 baby myrrhs each year, which are still anthropogenic, but the cause of those babies isn't like happening to every myrrh. It's happening to that parent and that juvenile. About halfway to learning how to fly, a myrrh jumps off the rock with dad and swims out to sea. And then they hang out with dad until they can fly. If they get separated for whatever reason, then those myrrhs don't do very well, and they either die or they wash up on the beach. And we would, from that, get about, say, like I said, 20 to 30 a year. And then the very next year after that, after 2015, we got 3, and then we got 0, and then we got 2, and then we got 0. And it's basically, you know, myrrhs have not been breeding very well on the west coast of North America since 2015. For seabirds, I feel like we're, as rehabilitators, we are right on the front line. We're getting information that is, you know, hot off the presses, something that's really been true for the history of the field. But only recently is it actually turning into something meaningful, because now we think about all of those paper records in every small town backyard rehabber's collection dating back over the last several decades. And you're like, that's a lot of data that's never going to be seen, never going to be looked at. But now, like, we're using a database that was actually a little plug to my friends, Rachel and Devin, who made the database, and it's being used throughout California by most of the big rehab facilities and across the nation and across the world. And CDFW has just made it, they're on the verge of making it like you need to use this database. And that's fantastic. You know, so now we have manipulable, sliceable, examinable data dating back to 2012. That's fantastic. As an aside, one of the things that's really valuable for us here in Humboldt is wildlife rehabilitation is mostly done by English and history majors. You know, if they have any college education at all. It's a field driven by compassion, not science. We use science to get our job done, but it's driven by compassion. But here in Humboldt, that's slightly different because we have HSU, which is an excellent school for getting a job as a wildlife biologist. So we have a lot of wildlife biologists in training that do volunteer and internships. And as soon as one of them comes and says, hey, I either want to be an intern or I'm looking for my senior project or something, I'm like, let me show you our database. And, you know, we can really make a lot of good use out of that, including analyzing things like our own success rate to analyzing, like if you want to really stop skunks from getting killed on highways, where are the places that a wildlife corridor should be put? And, you know, and that information is just sitting in our computer right now, waiting to be looked at. So that's an awesome partnership that I wasn't anticipating when we first instituted it, that HSU and HSU students were going to play a big part in.
All right, the Eco News Report, and we have Monty Merrick joining us, and we're talking about wildlife and how to avoid wildlife-human conflict. So besides adequate screening of areas to prevent wildlife from gaining access to someone's house, what are the other easy things that people can do to make less conflict between wildlife and humans?
Well, for mammals, protecting against moms raising their babies in your house is the number one thing that people can do, because it's things like keeping your trash covered so that you don't have nuisance raccoons in the neighborhood or nuisance bears or something like that. Most of the animals that we treat, though, are songbirds. Close to 70% of the animals we treat are songbirds. And the three things that take songbirds out are cats, windows, and cars. Cats is easy. Contain your cat.
And I know the local Audubon Society, they're making a big push for folks to start putting in catios. So if you still want to have your cat have some access to the outside, which I think, you know, we all want our cats to be happy. And I think that that's probably an important component of cat happiness. But you can have a little outdoor screen space that prevents them from going and chomping down on that bird.
I like cats.
Me too.
My girlfriend's got a cat. I like that cat a lot, but I don't keep a cat. But my neighbors feed cats. So my neighborhood is crawling with cats, including my backyard, which is otherwise habitat for a lot of frogs and birds and things that I really enjoy. I don't really know what to do. Is there anything I can do to make my backyard less attractive to the feral cats my neighbors are feeding?
Well, this is something that this is one of the hardest conversations that we have on the phone with people and cats, because for one thing, the last thing you really want to do is punch people out because they're compassionate, and that compassion leaks over onto cats.
Yeah, and I don't want to have any conflict with my neighbors at all. Yeah,
exactly.
I just occasionally spray a hose in the neighborhood of the cat.
Keeping feral cats out of your yard, especially feral cats that are part of, like, say, a feral cat colony that's being fed and maintained, I don't have a good answer for that.
It seems impossible.
It does seem impossible. I really think that feral cats are roughly here to stay. There's millions of them in the United States. There is no way in the world that we would not be turning ourselves into monsters if we started advocating eradicating those cats.
Australia does it.
They do. They have a totally different relationship with non-native species and how they operate it.
Right.
And that what they do, cane toads and rabbits and all that stuff. There are very powerful cat advocates in the United States, especially. And like the whole idea of community cats and no-kill shelters. Let's see how much I survive going against no-kill shelters.
Right.
But you're basically, when you are a no-kill shelter, you're essentially saying somebody else is going to deal with this problem, not us.
Right.
And turning cats that have been brought in back out is, in my view, my personal opinion of it, professionally informed, I guess, is that that's kind of madness. It's not really very nice to cats either, because first of all, the statistics, it's easy to find these statistics, is that cats that are kept on leashes, not that many cats like that, or used or catios or kept indoors or in some way controlled when they do go outside, those cats live a lot longer.
Right.
They don't generally die of feline leukemia or getting squashed by a car. Cats that are left free to roam in the neighborhood do.
Right.
I mean, I have two cats who I love to death. When I know that there's people out there that don't know where their cat is, I imagine putting myself in their shoes, and that would drive me insane. You know, like, oh, well, he'll come back. Just leave a window. It's like, well, we don't know he's going to come back. He has to cross the road to get here. In any case, eventually, I think that we're going to have to just become intelligent about this and realize that if we had somebody who was feeding bears or feeding raccoons, we would already know that that's inappropriate. That's turning a wild and free predator into a nuisance in our neighborhood. We have to do something similar, at least like that, with ferals. Your own cat, you should just treat them nicer.
Yeah.
So cats, windows, and cars. So solution for how to reduce human-wildlife conflict, in part, is deal with your cat.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that folks can do for windows or cars?
There's a lot of strategies for making your windows bird safe. And there's an awful lot of resources available on the internet. So like if what I say right now doesn't stick or doesn't land or you don't remember it, both American Bird Conservancy and the Cornell's Lab of Ornithology's site for the layperson all about birds, both of those sites have really excellent information on how to keep your windows safe. Basically, you know, it's obstacles that make the window not look like a passageway or that reduce the reflection. And there's stickers that you can put on your window. I don't think hawk stickers do anything.
They look really cool.
They do look cool. And they're nice to look at from the inside. And you're like, oh, there's a hawk. Oh, no, that's my sticker. But there's like these windows that make a matte section of bars that you can still see through. But from the outside, they don't reflect. And those are very handy. I know somebody that liked to hang like mobiles or wind chimes and stuff just in front of the windows. If you're building new, think about how you're siting your house so that you're not making it so that it's like a see-through glass box in the middle of the wilderness, because that will kill a lot of birds.
This is a tangent, but did anybody see the latest season of Silicon Valley, that HBO show that spoofs on Silicon Valley? Anyways, there's a whole part of an episode of this evil man's house, and one way that we know he is evil is that his house is completely made of glass, and every 30 seconds a bird runs into into it, and he has just a full-time person walking around the house to
picking up dead birds.
Anyways, so it's somewhat funny, perhaps for Monty, somewhat triggering.
Well, you know, one of the things I think is true is, like, you know, there's all kinds of things, individual houses with individual glass panes. Obviously, that's a trap for a bird. But where birds are getting wiped out in droves, of course, is skyscrapers. That's not something that we see here. We don't really deal with the aftermath of that, but wildlife rehabilitators in Chicago, New York, San Francisco, they see that all the time. I believe the Midwest is especially terrible just because of its presence in the flyways during migration. But I mean, millions of birds are taken out by buildings every year.
So I think this probably happened to all of us. We've been in a building, we've heard a smack on the window, we go out, we find a bird that's still very much alive, appears stunned. What do we do with that bird? How do we give it its best chance of survival?
Well, I'll start off with the olden days, which wasn't that long ago, like maybe 4 or 5 years ago. Our advice was put him in a box that doesn't have a lid and set that on your porch. And if he's still there in an hour and a half, bring him in to our clinic. If he's flown away, that's great. But we do not recommend that now. So that's now just draw a big line through that, because what we want you to do now is just bring him in.
Oh.
Because after analyzing some of the data and some of the types of injuries that birds die of in care after they've hit windows, we think that there's a strong likelihood that birds that fly off may be flying off to their death. And then, in fact, the act of flying off may actually do them in, because they may be experiencing cerebral hemorrhaging, and then the act of flight would exacerbate that, and then they die. So we basically suggest that as soon as you can, bring them to us. We get them in a warm, safe place with anti-inflammatories, and you typically we release them the next day. And if they're not able to be released the next day, we give them time. And then, of course, there's guys who just can't fly because they've actually caused a major injury, like they've messed up their shoulder in some way, coracoid fracture or something that renders them flightless, maybe not forever, or maybe forever.
What do you do with that wildlife that is rendered non-wild because of some sort of permanent debilitating injury?
Well, euthanasia is, as I mentioned at the very beginning of this when we were talking, you know, that's 50% of the patients we get are euthanized at the time that they're brought in because their injuries are so bad. So there's a lot of people that do not like that. We are a nonprofit 501c3, and the people of California own us. I believe that they have a right to know what we do.
Sure.
And I also think it's really important to just speak the truth about this, which is that we collectively do not allocate the resources necessary to take care of the millions of injured animals that need to be euthanized every year.
We're a small center.
Yeah.
Right? 1,300 animals a year.
Yeah.
And I just gave you a number like 50%. So yeah. You're like, okay, so where are those 650 animals going?
And just we don't support that as a society. So I don't think it's on you. It's on all of us.
And not only that, but
I also think it's the right choice. It's the moral choice in a lot of ways. And
I agree.
Happy to argue that with other people. But
yeah, thank you. I do too. And it's actually a topic that I'm really willing to talk about with people, because we're advocates for wildlife.
Right.
A wild animal's birthright is freedom. we have absolutely no way of being able to, as wildlife rehabilitators, it's not our job to argue with nature. It's our job to nurture it when we can and try to alleviate the crimes of humanity as we're able to, on a very limited scale, right? Really one wild animal at a time. Fortunately, there's gazillions of us. People like me exist in every community, and in like the Bay Area, my God, you can't swing a cat without hitting a wildlife rehabilitator. I don't recommend people swing cats. That's mean.
Monty Merrick, anti-cat swinging.
Yes, I'm willing to go down as that.
That's the campaign pledge. I think that's what a lot of pro-cat people, and I'm very pro-cat, I have three, would probably assume if you talk ill of cats going outside. So we've talked cars, we've talked windows, removing access areas. What are we missing?
So what about wildlife discovered on the beach?
Well, it depends on the wild animal. If it was a marine mammal around here, that would be sea lions, harbor seals are the most typical. It could be obviously other seals, northern fur seal. Those calls, we direct those directly to the local marine mammal center is the one in Crescent City. But they do have a stranding coordinator who works locally around the Bay Area. We do not even have a permit to treat marine mammals. That's handled by an entirely different agency. That's handled by NOAA. They have the permit for that. So we'll assist them if they want our help, which we've done. Like one night there was a sea lion trapped in a drainage ditch next to the Mad River slough crossing over onto Manila. It was like 9:30 at night and the sea lion was like sort of in the highway and then in the slough and in the ditch and whatnot. So we went out and helped, added muscle to the effort to get him dragged back to the water. Otherwise, they take those calls. People are more than welcome to call the Wildlife Care Center, 822-8839. And we will divert you, though, to the Marine Mammal Center.
You weren't actually talking about NOAA, a person. You were talking about the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration when you said
yes.
NOAA, otherwise known as NIMS, the National Marine Fisheries Service.
Correct. And they are the ones who are the regulatory agency for marine mammals.
Right.
Yeah. I have to say that they're really good about getting right back to that. They will go down, they'll check out the animal. Very often, a stranded seal isn't stranded at all. He's barked there by his mom. And everything's going fine. But if it's not going fine, then they'll monitor. Then by law, they have to monitor for 48 hours before they can pick up unless there's like an obvious problem.
So in most cases, you'd advise people to just leave the little seal pup alone?
Actually, I would always advise that they just call because I don't think it's really fair to people to put the onus of diagnosis or deciding the best course of action is. People don't have training to do that, and they can, oh, no, he's probably fine. You know, I just read on the internet that 99% of all seals are fine, so let's just leave this guy alone. And if that's that 1% guy, you just walked away from him. So I would recommend people call us, call the Marine Mammal Center, pass off the decision-making on that to people that have taken on the responsibility.
So you've voluntarily taken on this responsibility. How can folks support the Wildlife Care Center in your work?
Well, there's a couple ways. The number one way that people can support us is with money because
it takes money to
cost money.
Yeah.
Right. We have a phone bill. We have an electric bill. We have a water bill. We have a food bill, medicine bill, that sort of thing. We also have staff. So that's a number one way.
I want to make clear, you do feed your patients birdseed.
We do, yeah.
Just saying.
We feed them. Yeah. Another way, of course, is, and this is also very valuable, is people can volunteer. We have a lot of labor that needs to be done. I can tell you that I began as a volunteer 21 years ago up in Seattle.
And look at you now.
And look at me now. Right. Possibly a cautionary tale. But yeah, volunteering is a fantastic way to help wild animals. It's also a great way to learn some basic animal care. Or it doesn't even have to be learning animal care. You know, if all you want to do is come in and fold towels for 3 hours, that's a huge benefit to us. That's fantastic. Just by being a voice of reason in your neighborhood is another great way. When you know that your neighbor's feeding cats, just help them out and decide to do the right thing. Or if you know people are not put unsecured trash. I think every year, it seems like, since I've lived in Humboldt, which is 11 years now, I think that there's been like a bear killed somewhere in our community because he got into trash.
Yep.
It seems silly, but just a secure trash can saves a bear's life. There's things like that. But to circle back to the primary way is, like I said, our final number for 2019 was 1,332 patients, which is the most HWCC has treated in its, now in its 41st year.
Wow.
In 1 year. You know, I attribute that to a lot of things. Number one is maybe more public awareness that wild animals are there. And also that we're here. We still get called. I've lived in McKinleyville 40 years. Never heard of you guys. I don't know who I'm imitating with that voice. Just some random person that didn't know about us. But it's obviously on us to get the word out that we exist. So we do strive to do that, and people can help with that.
And how can people get in contact with you? I found a bird.
Our phone number is 707-822-8839. That is the best way to get a hold of us. People do contact us about injured animals through our info@birdallyx.net email and through our Facebook page. If you do that on either one of those things, you're really delaying. Just give us a call. If you are not able to give us a call and that's the only way you have, then okay, use it. But it's really the least effective way to get a hold of us. Well, no, and other thoughts and prayers would be the least effective way to get a hold of us.
All right, there we go.
Monty Merrick, literalist. What's the most extraordinary story of wildlife recovery you've participated in?
Yes, let's have a happy story.
Oh my God, there's so many.
What's the one you like to tell the most?
Did you have a favorite patient?
There was a pelican who, as I was working in the San Francisco Bay Area, there was a pelican who was found in a grocery store parking lot. It was a juvenile pelican, and it was one of those years when there was a huge eruption of juvenile pelicans all over the place, winding up in strange places. If you saw the movie Pelican Dreams, this was the same year that that bird landed on the Golden Gate Bridge, the bird that's in Pelican Dreams. So this bird had wound up in a parking lot. Where I was working at the time, it was a crappy release site. I hated it, but it had excellent photo ops. So the place always took pelicans down to the beach on the Sausalito side, and you can see the Golden Gate Bridge. So all photographs of pelican releases had the Golden Gate Bridge in the background. Easy to see why it was chosen. Except for I didn't think it was best for pelicans because there was a fishing pier right there waiting. And so that bird was released and then was found on that fishing pier 4 days later with fishing line entanglement. And so we brought him back. We released him again after he'd recovered. And then he turned up in another store parking lot trying to walk into a store. And this bird's 4 months old, right?
It seems like he's starting to clue in.
Yeah.
You know, that's where the fish is.
So it was really the conversation that we were having.
That's hilarious.
Was this bird might get euthanized.
Right.
Because how many times do we release you and get you back? And we knew it was him because that facility banned.
So he's birds. A recidivist, really.
Yes, quite. Yeah. But he's also 4 months old. Pelicans live to be about 40.
Whoa.
They're apex predators, really.
Right.
They have a steep learning curve. They also have a steep dive.
But they mature at about a year?
Yeah. They're mature at about a year and sexually mature, maybe a little bit older than that.
Yeah. So this is a teenager at best. Yeah.
At best. Like, seriously, he like hatched, learned to fly on one of the Channel Islands, made it to San Francisco, and his life turned bad.
There's a Grateful Dead song in here somewhere.
Yeah. Especially with a San Francisco setting.
Exactly.
So I suggested that we could choose a better release site for him. Someplace where there was other pelicans that were living a more natural pelican life, where there might be adults, because the bay at that time was just, it was thronging. There was a ton of juvenile pelicans in the Bay Area, but juvenile pelicans, there was not a single one that knew what this guy should be doing instead. So I put the pelican in my car and we headed for the mouth of the Russian River, which I happened to know was a huge pelican hangout. And we got to the pelican hangout and there was no pelicans. My whole plan, which I had, was a hard sell with my colleagues that I was working with who were largely wanted to euthanize. The whole plan was contingent on we're going to get him into a group with adults.
Good peer group.
Yes, exactly. So we started driving north up one from the mouth of the river. I pulled into a little spot. I can't remember all the names of the little ocean access points that we'd pull into. And I saw this group of pelicans, about 25 of them, that were coasting along. You know, they were just headed north. And they were making good time because they were not lollygagging. They were, and it was really wonderful. I don't know how much you've seen pelicans using the surf to propel their movement up and down the coast. It's
one of the finest sites on this planet.
You're like, the original surfers.
Yeah.
And they're fantastic. Just nothing better than watching that happen. So I kept missing the opportunity to get the bird that we had out of my car, the crate to a good spot, open the crate, him fly out just in time to see this group of pelicans coming. And it kept missing it. And finally, we put the pedal to the metal and got to Point Arena. We had about 15, 20 minutes, but there was no pelicans. But I'm like, we got him over to that bluff. There's a very big open area, really right up to the lighthouse. It's a long, straight, rocky cliff about 30 feet high. I got the carrier and I had it set up. And by the time I got it there and we were open and ready to open the door, and I set it so that he was going to step out of the crate and into flight. He wasn't going to get a chance to dawdle. It was basically like, there's a 30-foot cliff in front of you. Goodbye. I look and that group of pelicans has arrived. And he stepped out. He launched himself off that cliff and just swooped off and went down. And he turned into about the 13th bird in the line out of the 30 or so. He went around the bend. I watched him through binoculars until he cleared the lighthouse and I couldn't see him anymore.
Yay.
And that was, yeah.
That's a good feeling.
I don't even like going on releases technically. Truthfully, they stress me out. I'd rather just have volunteers come back and say it went great. But that was, I was so glad to be there to see that.
Thank you, Monty.
Yeah, that was very nice. Well, Monty, thank you so much for joining the Eco News Report. And thank you for all the work that you do on behalf of our wildlife.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.